This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about Pool of Radiance, that advanced D&D game that is brand new on Steam as of March of this year. But of course, that's the SSI game that started the hit Gold Box series through the 1990s. And hopefully I'm going to be getting some hints about that today because, of course, I'm playing Pool of Radiance on the late Thursday night Elder Games stream, and I'm having a blast with it, playing through for the very first time with fresh eyes, and I'm looking forward to getting some inside skinny from Paul and our viewers so that I am not running around like a chicken with my head cut off on Thursday night this week again.
Yeah, I'll recommend anyone in the chat who wants to chime in. We're gonna try hard here to not spoil any of the content for Dan, but help him out where cases where the interface is maybe a little clunky and not intuitive, which it certainly is because it's an old game. I'm gonna put up the image here of the box, which I am amused to see has the label on it that this is the version for the Commodore 64. So Dan, you're just playing it for the first time, right? This is you've never
Absolutely.
Played this game before, and that's amazing.
Never.
So my history of the game is a little bit longer, because I remember. Actually, let's see. I think I have an image for this. I remember seeing this advertisement in the back of a Dragon magazine, I believe, or in the pages of a Dragon magazine somewhere, or at least one like it. For this game. That's how I first learned about it in 1988 when it came out. I remember going to Electronics Boutique and seeing it there for the astronomical price of $55, which was how much video games went
really?
For in 1988. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember eating my allowance so that I could go out and buy it. It's the first ever video game I ever bought. I bought it for an IBM compatible. My dad had an 8086 or something like that. So I played it on that. And my stepdad had a Tandy 16 that I played it on. The first machine that I played it on, I think, had a whopping 16 colors, perhaps, whereas the Tandy was monochrome and shades of green. But I think I've also played it on Commodore. Wow. Friend played it on Commodore. I mean, this game's been ported. This game's been ported around a bit. I don't know if you realize this, Dan, but there was a port made for the Nintendo Entertainment System. You could play this game on Nintendo.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Yep. Huh. So this game has seen the round. Now it's on Steam.
I guess I'm seeing there was a Sega Genesis version.
Yeah, not surprised by that. I wasn't aware of that one, but I knew there was an NES version. Lately, I have, I don't know when I bought this, probably just as DOS games were dying, I bought the Forgotten Realms Archive, which is a set of DVDs, which is just raw copies of the binaries to DVD, pretty much. But it's got the whole gold box is on here. Pool of Radiance, Curse of the Azerbaijan, Secret of Silver Blades, Fools of Darkness, Hillsfar, all of the Eye of the Beholders games, Dungeon Hack, all kinds of Mens Maranzen, all sorts of stuff.
We like Dungeon Hack.
Yeah.
Let me just. So as we're starting here, I'll just throw up William's recollection of how we should really start. If we're going to start Pool of Radiance, how it should be started.
Yeah.
This load quote star comma 8 comma 1 command. Thank you.
So these days I'm playing it from those CDs. I ripped it off the CD and installed DOSBox to run a DOS emulator, and that's how I play it.
Yeah. And to be clear, so on Thursday nights, I am playing it on Steam. So it came, you know, so Pool of Radiance, I think maybe 10 years ago, had like a revisit on from GOG, G-O-G, right? And GOG.com. And then it was just released about 2 or 3 months back now, I guess 3 months back on Steam. And to be clear, it's part of the Forgotten Realms Collection 2. Is where it is. So if anybody was interested in revisiting it, that's where it is. Let me ask this, Paul, because you know, I've played two sessions for a total of about 4 hours of playtime, and I think I'm about halfway through the slums, which is the very first place with monsters. And so I'm wondering if you can tell me, like, how much total playtime I can look forward to. And then, like, on that disc, how much total playtime would there be on the entire Gold Box series put together? Because maybe that's what I'm queuing up to do on Thursday nights now.
Wow. Quite a bit. Now, this game pretty faithfully implements first edition AD&D. It's not complete by any means. I think you noticed on your stream that it's only got like the core races and classes. It doesn't have any subclasses like Paladin and Druid and such. I do think that later games in the Gold Box series does start to introduce some of that stuff. Obviously not every spell is implemented, but anyway, I will say this from my experience developing video games, and actually, well, when I flip this, I'll pose this as a question to you, Dan. Which level in your average video game gets the most attention and most development time from a
So I will point out that as Paul and I, in the couple minutes before we came online, we fell into this pipe, but basically we started talking about our video game experience and how we would have approached this and all that kind of stuff and what language it's in. So there's a very critical article from Game Developer Magazine that I always remember about this is the one that gets the most attention is usually the first level, the introduction, maybe the tutorial, the first one, and usually the very last conclusion gets almost no attention. And the point of that article that was in the very last issue of Game Developer is developers, no one's paying any attention to the end of the game, so you can do whatever you want there. Go ahead and make whatever you want happen at the end, because that's your field for creative endeavors, but it's the start that everybody's going to be looking at very carefully. Is that what you expected for that, Paul?
Yep, exactly. And I will say that the slums probably has the most varied content in the game, that you will go through other blocks faster than you go through the slums.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and it makes sense, right? Because like the first level of your game is the thing that's going to get played the most, right?
Yep.
Everyone's going to play the very first bit. Not everyone's going to make it all the way to the end.
And to be clear, I've been encountering so far is like it's basically your standard first level. So of course, the thing set, if our viewers don't know, the thing is set in the Forgotten Realms in a city that's being rebuilt from a ruin called Flan. And so you start off on a very small block that has civilized stuff and temples for healing and shops and stuff. And the very next thing you walk into is basically a first level dungeon of slums you're trying to reclaim. And I'm fighting all the standard first level monsters of goblins and orcs and kobolds. And basically that's what I've seen so far.
Yeah. I expect, given that you're two sessions in, I expect you'll get a good dozen out of the game at least.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting.
And I don't know how much for the whole Gold Box series. Jeez, I never made it through all that. I will say Pool of Radiance, I played to the end multiple times. I can think Pool of Radiance stands out to me as like the best of the series.
Tell me why. Tell me what about it made it replayable? What dragged you back into it multiple times? Well,
there's a couple of things. One is that I think it focuses the mechanics into a narrower band, right? Like I said, it's missing a lot of the more, you know, esoteric character classes and et cetera. It starts you at first level. And so it's got, it's got some of the most fun parts of the leveling arc of a D&D party, I think. The design of the content, like they were, it's more, I almost want to say simplistic, maybe that's not the right word, but I feel like later on in the series, right, they're trying to make each game more and more impressive than the last. And so they're going out of their way to design content that is interesting and unusual. Whereas Pool of Radiance, I feel like most of the encounters you're encountering in the slums are probably wandering monsters.
Got it.
Right? It's very simulationist in that way. There's certainly set encounters. There's certainly, you're going to go into specific rooms and see specific things. Definitely that happens. And frankly, that also makes the game a little grindy. There's so many wandering monsters that part of being able to complete the game for me, and probably most people I think will say this, is learning how to avoid some of the wandering monsters.
Okay. Interesting.
Because you can just get bogged down by that.
That was part of my... It's true. That's true. It's turn-based. You have as much... You're running a whole party of up to, up to possibly 8 people is what I'm reading. I only have a party of 5 at the moment. But it's turn-based, so you do one at a time pick the action of every single character on your party, and you have the opportunity at least to sit down and reflect on it as much as you want. I wouldn't want to play, it is on a battle map miniature type situation, so I wouldn't want to actually play D&D at the table like that. If it's a solo game, no one's preventing you from playing faster or slower, so there's no, it's not multiplayer in any way, so there's no reason why not to do that, I suppose. One of the things, of course, I'm exploring is, okay, it's branded Advanced D&D. I get it. First edition, but you never know what level of fidelity, someone making a video game is going to match the actual rules of Dungeons and Dragons. And, you and I, Paul, have had this experience of when you sit down to code a tabletop role-playing game, inevitably there's these places that were left maybe intentionally ambiguous for the referee to adjudicate, and now you actually do have to code up a specific formal rule for that. And mm-hmm. I see and there's actually a quote from the developer of Pool of Radiance actually, who said the same thing. I see the SSI team developing the game was led by Chuck Krogel. Krogel stated that the main challenge with the development was interpreting the AD&D rules to an exact format. So as I come into it, I'm wondering, are there going to be wandering monsters? Is the experience working the same way? That kind of stuff. So that was kind of a question mark I had in my session last Thursday of I'm in the dungeon area. Now I need to get back. Is it clear or are they wandering monsters? And I did not know whether that was a threat or not. And the answer was yes. And I barely made it out with my life as a result. So
one of the fun things for me watching you play the game, beyond just the enjoyment of seeing the first time you encounter some of this stuff, because like one of the things for me playing the game now, if I play it again, which I have started playing it again just because you piqued my interest, is blasting through the slums pretty fast, because I've played the slums a lot. I know where everything is. I know the slums by heart. So it's not as exciting for me, right? I want to get through it so that I can get onto the other blocks where I start to not really remember the content so well. So I can at least be a little bit surprised by what happens in the game. But the slums, I'm like, I just got to tear through this because, whew.
Interesting.
And it's tough. It's tough. It runs the AD&D rules pretty closely. One of the things I really enjoyed in watching you, Dan, is that sometimes you wonder about a thing and you quote AD&D rules, which you know way better than I do. And I'm always kind of surprised, they totally did implement it. That Dan's exactly right, and I didn't realize that was standard AD&D rules, like the whole system around unconsciousness and bandaging. Right. And so then of course, I'm watching it going just find the band. It's under the done menu. I know that's weird.
Yeah. Thursday, I was on the cusp of that happening. And I actually did pull out my actual first edition Dungeon Master's guide and looked up that part. Yeah. Anybody, you go to negative hit points and anybody's supposed to be able to resuscitate you, stabilize you. And then fortunately a viewer a couple minutes Once I had someone down, a couple minutes later, a viewer pointed out where the bandage option was in the user interface. So that was a particularly funny one. It's interesting that like a large challenge, like I'm exploring dungeons, but like I'm also exploring the user interface. And like a large part of this game is discovering things that actually kind of aren't listed in the manual, and exploring where in the user interface. And like actually, I didn't even put it on the stream, but I had a really hard time finding out how to add a character to my party after I'd started the game. And you have to go to a particular place. Like you have to go to a particular geographic place in the town. You have to go through a user interface. It kind of isn't telling you that before I could add somebody.
There's a lot of menus, as we can see in the graphic here. This is looking at a character, and there's, you know, menus, basically the words with the white letters, the key you have to press, because, of course, this game is pre-mouse, right? So you're playing with a keyboard only. And yeah, not all of it's intuitive, but they tried really hard, right? They did a lot of stuff where they customized the menu based on context, which is sometimes good, but also sometimes infuriating, right? Like I watched you struggle with how do I sell an item? Well, it's in the items menu under a character, but only while you're in a shop talking to the shopkeeper.
And I had to go to a shop, talk to the shopkeeper, then view the character. Right. Then go to their items and then the sell button shows up finally. So it's like about four or five levels deep before that's an option. So that I did struggle with that. And yet the funny thing is I kind of don't mind it. You know, the funny thing is I kind of don't mind this challenge actually of exploring a slightly threatening series of passages that I could go down. Weirdly, I'm like, that actually sort of, I don't know if that I'm just grew up with the right era, but that actually sort of feels right of discovering what the game itself lets me do is actually part of the challenge. And I actually don't mind it, strangely.
I'm trying to look for, it looks like all of our screenshots are showing portraits. Here's a picture of the back of the box.
They are.
You can kind of see some of the interfaces there, but like in the general exploration mode, right, they had this weird kind of first person-y view, right? And you're kind of like paging through first person shots of each square. And granted, you can then jump to a top down map, which is lovely, just gray on gray, and you're an arrow. not for a game that was highly praised for its graphics, it's a little surprising, I suppose, sometimes to look at the fidelity of this stuff.
And Paul is right that at the time it was in fact highly acclaimed for the great graphics. Part of it, I think, was really mostly the portraits, actually, I think is what got the most acclaim, because if you're familiar with the first edition Monster Manual, like that illustration of a kobold right there is directly inspired by the art out of the first edition Monster Manual. So the monsters are clearly replicants of those really great pieces of artwork, and plus they're animated. That surprised me on Thursday. It's like I actually saw it's weird because I saw an illustration like this, and I'm like, yeah, that's the picture of the Monster Manual. I get it. And then it started moving, and somehow that really freaked my brain out that pictures in the Monster Manual aren't supposed to be animated. And I was like, what the?
Yeah. That's great. And even in the battle view, the icons are, you know, they're highly pixelated, but they're kind of, you know, a decentish representation of what you saw in the Monster Manual, I think.
Well, the funny thing is on the player character icons, there is like a almost egregiously large number of options for customizing the icons. And in fact, that I actually had, I mean, I did some of that in the first session, but I think it took me an hour to go through the options for all different icons. And so when I made up a new character, I did that offline, because you can really get lost in the options for skinning and fine tuning what your characters look like in the game, which was I didn't expect to have that many options, frankly.
Yeah, it's definitely a very highly customizable one. In fact, one of the other things I remember you noticing you go through is discovering that in the character generation part, you can actually manually modify the raw stats of your character, like the six core attributes and the hit points, which seems very cheaty, except that the game was originally, the way the game was originally marketed, they said you could take your actual D&D characters and enter them into this game. And it's kind of true. Kind of.
Yeah, I found that I found that in the manual.
Characters, and they only use the basic character classes and races.
Good point. Good point. Yep. Good point. Yeah, I found that in the manual a day or two ago, and I'm like, oh, because you know because what it actually winds up doing is you can just arbitrarily change your character stats to whatever you want. So, Paul, how did you use that back in the day? Did you replicate tabletop characters?
No, I tried, and then was you know, disappointed that a lot of the options weren't there. So, like any good 9-year old, I then just gave all my characters straight 18s, of course.
Good for you, Paul.
Like you do.
Good for you. Give your characters a fighting chance, I say.
Yeah. It's still what hard. I'm doing... Let me tell you, even with straight 18s, it's still a hard game, which I really
That's what
appreciate.
I read. I read that, and someone was like, yeah, it's equally hard to Temple of Elemental Evil. And I'm like, well, that wasn't what I was signing up for. I was signing up for a casual little game on Thursday. So when I initially started, you're allowed to make 6 characters, and I guess there's slots for 2 NPCs to maybe show up. And I actually only made 4 characters. And to my mind, and it's funny because as an original D&D player, the even though it's AD&D branded, as Paul said, you've got just the 4 races from original D&D, human, elf, dwarf, halfling, and you just have the 4 classes from original D&D plus Greyhawk, which is fighter, magic user, cleric, thief. And it's weird because to me, it feels like I'm just playing original D&D, which is great. It's basically an OT&D game. And I thought, well, these are all the options you want. And I made all 4 races. I had a character that was human, dwarf, elf, halfling. That's clearly everything. I only need 4 people. Am I just being suicidal at even trying to play the game with 4 or 5 characters? Or do I need 6, Paul?
There are certain encounters where you will need all 6. And in fact, okay. You probably noticed this, but if you go into the area in town where you can train your characters to gain levels, one of the other things you can do is hire hirelings there. And there are some encounters that maybe you want the two slots filled with hirelings.
Okay.
Now, all right. Now classic problem, though, of hirelings, they consume some of your XP. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't know if
and
you
also
noticed
money,
how
like
XP is doled out in the game. Yeah, money as well, yeah.
Because when I did go into the training area, they had some folks offering to join, and they weren't first level. They were higher than first level, but then they were saying that they're expecting like 3 shares of treasure. So they're going to get half my treasure the way I'm going. So I declined.
Here's a gotcha for you in the interface, by the way. If you do end up taking some NPCs with you, you can use the interface to trade items to them. But you can't take them away.
Oh,
once you give them
an
NPC, it's theirs.
Oh, fascinating. Oh, I'm glad you told me that. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You would totally.
Thanks for the +1 sword, buddy.
Yeah.
It's fine now.
Yeah. I mean, so that would be surprising. I would totally get tricked by that. But again, that's just classic D&D is you give stuff to your henchmen. Yeah. Right, and they are kind of selfish. They're not a generous party member like everybody else. That's totally what should happen, frankly.
Yeah. It is nice that there's elements that I've just internalized. Like I don't have to go digging for XP charts. I can just look at the character sheet and I kind of know how much XP the different classes need to level because it's ingrained in my head. You could look it up in your player's handbook. Did you notice that only characters who actually survive the fight get XP?
I had not yet.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, you know so what, now that you mentioned, I noticed the fight where most everybody was down. Yeah, most everybody was down, yeah. And then it said every character gets this amount, and it was much higher than the prior fights. I see.
Right, yep, because it only goes to surviving characters.
Interesting.
So, you know, interesting. You can game it a little bit, right? You can after you beat that fight, that very tough fight with your hirelings, you can continue the battle and kill your hirelings, you know, if you want.
Oh, that's I would feel bad about that. I'm a big, you know me, Paul. I'm a big softy. I would feel really bad about that.
Yeah. You know, it is. I will say, the other thing I'll say about this game is that it holds up, frankly, even though the graphics are not awesome anymore, and the interface is difficult. I'm enjoying the crap out of playing it.
That's great. I'm glad that I feel like that's very promising for my first time playthrough, actually. Interesting. I mean, one thing that even I, because this is now the earliest video game that I've played on the stream, and as you the further you drill down in time, the more truly mercilessly brutal D&D was. And even I am, taken aback a little bit to refresh my memory about how just totally merciless it was. And I've been playing, Dungeon Hack, which is a solo mega dungeon. And I get through it and I put the settings on a very easy level. But even there, paralysis and poison were nerfed, frankly, from actual D&D rules. In Dungeon Hack, paralysis, you can't attack, but you can still run away. So you can run away until the paralysis wears off. And poison starts, you're not instantly dead. You just, a couple hit points go away every minute or so, and then you can go find a solution to that. And I started playing, so now I'm back in Pool of Radiance, and I start playing. I accidentally tag, I accidentally tagged one of my own characters with a sleep spell. And I was like, is that even a thing? Does the game even possibly hit your characters with friendly fire? I'm not sure. So that happens. And there's no saving throw. My character goes down. And then the very next thing that happens is the monster next to him gets a free automatic kill. So one round later, and that's the rule.
It wasn't free. For what it's worth, it wasn't free. It just happened to be that monster's turn next.
It's true. But the first edition rule is if someone's unconscious and helpless, you automatically hit them and you automatically kill them. And that's exactly what happened. So one slight misstep by, frankly, one space, and my character is automatically gone. And it's interesting, early D&D, it was a war game, right? And go ahead.
I was going to say, one of my favorite moments, talking about how merciless this game is, one of my favorite moments watching you play the game is the first time you get TPK'd, because it gives you a little message that says, the monsters rejoice having slain the party, and then the game quits. And it's just like, you're out.
Yeah.
We're done
playing.
Yeah,
the application.
You gotta relaunch the game.
Yeah, it kicks you out of the application. You're back in the DOS command line. I was like, wow. Holy, wow.
Yeah, it's great. It's kind of like the equivalent of like the DM. There's a TPK, and the DM just like packs up his books. Like, no, we're done.
Now I finally understand why programs are called executables.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Now, of course, the fact that you've got a whole party, right, gives you a little bit of a buffer zone. So losing one character, I have been TPK twice already, but losing one character doesn't immediately end the game, because at least in first edition, you have the opportunity to, as we said, bandage, haul the body out, get them rested up, which takes weeks of time to heal up from a zero hit point situation. In first edition, obviously there's a difference between having, that was a thing that we were all wrestling with early D&D rules about, like, what's the experience of losing one character versus the experience if you have a couple characters that you could be running at the same time. And so at least I can still keep playing most of the time as long as I can haul my dead bodies out, my unconscious bodies out.
Yeah, I don't know if you'll run into this one naturally, so I'm I feel like I'm gonna tell you about this one, Dan, because it's hilarious. If you, I was playing the other night, and a bunch of my guys went down, And I knew I was losing the battle, right? I was like, this is over. This is going to end in TPK. I had one character left, and so I started running for the edge of the board, which I think you've already discovered that's how you flee the battle, right? Just to exit off the edge of the board.
A viewer informed me about that.
Yeah. So what do you think happens in this case where I had one thief left, everyone else was downed, and my thief makes it to the edge of the board? What would you expect the game to do?
I would have a huge question mark. So I would imagine the two options are you just lose the people you left behind, or the people are still with you. I could imagine game doing either one.
They're gone. It says you flee, and your party now just has that one character in it, and the other ones are just gone.
Wow. Yep. Right. I mean, you know, realistic.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, right, is that like you can go buy a raise dead spell in the temples. So like even if your character is killed, there is an out if you can make it out with their bodies. But yeah, that's really actually hard to do sometimes, right? You have to lose a little bit, but not too much.
Interesting. Huh. Okay. Yeah. And I was close to it. I was close to another TPK on Thursday night. And as I think Nathan Foley on Twitter was pointing out, like a major tactical question is how much do you push your resources into the dungeon area? Because you have to keep a little bit held back so that you can get out through the wandering monsters that you're going to run into. And me not even knowing whether that was an issue or not, I basically pushed myself to the limit, started coming back, discovered that wandering monsters were a part of the mechanic, and out of five people, I wound up with three down, and I was left with like a half-damaged thief and my magic user character, and just barely managed to pull the other three bodies out of the situation before a TPK happened, actually. So,
that's fun.
And it's interesting, right? So that's, I mean, you know, wandering monsters have sort of gotten a bad name or sort of been just bleached out of, you know, standard Dungeons & Dragons now in 2020. I think the knock is usually like, what's the plot? What's the story? What's the meaning of this? And at least at the time, it was a serious strategic concern about in this unknown area, do you have the resources? How much do you risk pushing forward in order to get your ass out? Because the getting out is not for free.
Yeah, there are some part of Pool of Radiance, I will say, is finding those safe havens where you can stop and rest. That is not common. But I do think wandering monsters, though. Sorry to go back to wandering monsters. I think one of the interesting things is they become tedious when you're in, I think, a computer game setting and you have the ability to save and restore the game, right? Once you can kind of like always save and go back a step, then I feel like at that point, like you no longer care about like, you know, things that would just kill you on a die roll, right? Which is essentially what a wandering monster is. Like, am I lucky or not? And then, you know, I think there's nothing more annoying than like you're trying to complete some major arc of the story and you just keep getting unlucky and you go back and you restore the game from the save point, you try again, get unlucky again, like, damn it, if I could just get through without rolling a wandering monster, I'll make it. And that's tedious and boring. That does not make for a game. That's my theory.
It's funny, what would you do? I guess I haven't had that experience yet. Maybe I'm a masochist. Like if you were designing or redesigning Pool of Radiance as a game designer yourself now, what direction would you go? Would you remove the wandering monsters? Would you make limited save points like some games do? What would your solution to that be?
That is a really interesting question. I would probably go with limited save points, frankly. Like, it makes sense to me that maybe you can save, that saving should be as difficult as resting, right? If I'm in an area where I can't rest, then I shouldn't be able to save either.
Yeah, I can see
that's what my game wants, right? Because you don't want them just, otherwise they're just going to save every time. Oh, I got this thing, save. Oh, I accomplished this goal, save, right? And then you just get into that loop, which is dull. But I like the Wandering Monsters. I like, but one of the things I, you know, frankly, watching, sitting here and playing Pool of Radiance, of course, I'm immediately struck as a game designer of like, this is clearly they had a good engine for implementing AD&D rules because they went on to many games in this series. And my thought was like, I wonder how modular it is. Could you, like, has it been hacked enough? Because the game certainly has been hacked a lot, right? There's some that companion app now that like scrapes data out of memory and allows you to do stuff that the game wouldn't normally let you do, right? Where was I going with that?
There was, at the end of the Gold Box series.
So could you create new content using, like, is there some way to separate the engine from the content and create new content? That would be interesting to me. What I would love to see, honestly, is outdoor spoliation implemented in this.
Oh, yeah.
I want to see something that is completely procedural.
Yeah,
that was
interesting. There were, of course, at the end of the series, right? I mean, you evolve the Gold Box engine about 10 years forward, and I think one of the very last things they released was Forgotten Realms Unlimited Adventures. Okay, I guess that was only 5 years later. So in 93, they released Forgotten Realms Unlimited Adventures, and I think that was an engine for like player-made content. I think is that you could make your own dungeons and stuff based on that.
Okay. Here's an interesting tidbit for you. Here's an interesting tidbit for you about this line of games. There was a game released on the AOL network called Neverwinter Nights. This is not the Neverwinter Nights that most people think of, built by BioWare. This is an earlier version. It came out in 1991. It's the interface is just like this, looks just like Pool of Radiance, but you're only controlling one character and it's a multiplayer game. Right. So that's cool. That's interesting. Right. Hop forward and maybe in 2002, I think BioWare comes out with a game called Neverwinter Nights. Confusing that they didn't brand it as like, you know, Neverwinter Nights remastered or like they didn't put any language on it that made it anything other than confusing. Right. But it's a whole new game implemented with much fancier graphics. And one of the selling points of the newer Neverwinter Nights, sorry, there's a police car going right by my window right now. Okay, that's fun. One of the things that they implemented in that was this idea of DM mode, right? One player could become the DM and could just drop stuff into the game and use their scripting language to create content. And so there was this whole suite of tools for creating your own content for Neverwinter Nights in the BioWare game released in 2002. And what do you think, like, one of the most, maybe not most popular, but certainly the fan-made content that I remember most that was built in this system was a recreation of the original Pool of Radiance.
Really? Okay, really? Crazy.
Yeah. Square for square, they recreated the entirety of the content of Pool of Radiance in Neverwinter Nights.
Wow. Crazy. Yeah. I wouldn't expect it that. Dark?
Yeah, slightly different, only in that Neverwinter Nights from BioWare in 2002 was implemented in third edition D&D rules. So you're playing the content of Pool of Radiance, but with third edition rules instead of first edition rules.
I remember hearing about that engine, and I remember hearing about how that worked, and actually I was fairly attracted to it. I did not actually pick it up, but I at the time I remember having a pretty good appetite, actually. That sounds very interesting, and I was very close to picking that up and starting to make content for it, actually. I will say, like, on, like, you know, people recreating Pool of Radiance, I mean, it was very popular. And I'm seeing for, you know, it was a hit at the time. It got like 90%, Pool of Radiance got like 90% ratings in the game review magazines. It still gets tended to get listed as like a top five or top 10 all-time D&D video game when people make historical lists like that. Sold, guess how much Pool of Radiance sold for copies sold for a
number of copies sold. I don't know. 1 million.
Okay. No? So you're on the right order of magnitude. So Pool of Radiance itself sold a bit over 250,000. over a quarter million.
Okay.
And then the, you know, by far SSI's biggest seller, I think, of all time, the entire Gold Block series altogether sold, even that didn't hit a million, sold 800,000 altogether. So Pool of Radiance alone is, what is it, like about a third of the entire Gold Block series for sales, which is kind of interesting. It says here, even the hint book, even the supplemental hint book outsold any earlier SSI game.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
Right?
Jeez. I mean,
so we have a lot of mindshare.
Like we talked a little bit about how many different platforms Pool of Radiance was adapted to, right? You've got, you know, your Commodore version, your NES version, your Genesis version. Also point out that there was a D&D module written so you could play it.
Yes.
There was a novelization so you could read the novel about it. This thing had legs, man. This content had legs.
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of really good questions in the chat here from viewers that I'm very interested in. Like, I'm not even sure how I would answer it. So Bill Rubine was asking a related question. We're talking about the difficulty level and the wandering monsters and the saving theory and stuff like that. So Bill's asking a related question, DMing a tabletop game. What do you do when your players play badly? Just let them die slowly? That's not fun. And then he continues, grind out boring wandering monster encounters because they're not being careful.
What do you do? What do you do, Dan?
Okay, so I do tend to be simulation. I do tend to be simulationist, and I actually do. I mean, you know, players can have a TPK and they can all die. So that's okay. That's a really interesting question, Bill. That's a hard question. Yeah.
It's a hard question, right? Because you also kind of never know when the players are going to turn it around, right? Because the players can do that sometimes, right? You may look like it's inevitable that they're going to lose, and then they'll do something brilliant, and you'll go, and that's the most exciting moment, right? We were down. We thought everyone was going to die. This player did this brilliant thing, turned it all around, saved the day. You don't want to close the door to that. But, you know, I certainly, like, if it's looking in ruin, right, if all but one of the characters are dead, I might fast forward a little. I might be willing to say, like, okay, we're just going to take it as written that such and such happens, right? Your character somehow manages to slip away, or we'll just assume you die on the way home and let's all make new characters. Whatever the mood of the table and the contract of the social contract of the table is
the part of Bill's question that is making it particularly difficult for me is the die slowly phrase. Like if Bill hadn't put die slowly in there, I feel like I would be answering this a lot more easily. I do think that, like, being just a little bit OCD and being like the text is the law, in the past, I think I have actually veered toward making that mistake, possibly, about letting things, in fact, grind out too long. And I'm thinking, like, the time when I somewhat embarrassedly had you, Paul, mapping all the minutiae of the maze section of Rappahannock, right? I'm really embarrassed about that in retrospect. So we did that for really, really too long, Paul mapping out the little mazy section while the rest of the party was like, we'll really look forward to when Paul tells us that we're on the other end of this. And then in a later session, finally hand waving it and saying, okay, you're going to spend a while at this and there's probably a wandering monster in the middle. So I think I've tried to grow and get better at starting to abstract that action out when it's clear what's happening in those kinds of cases. I mean, I've had sufficiently smart and good players that actually just hasn't been an issue that they were going to slowly die to repeated wandering monsters, as they either do something to fix that or they pull out or something. So,
I feel like I've seen, maybe I'm making this up, but I feel like I've seen games where the players are basically out of resources and they're acknowledging like, wow, one wandering monster and we're just going down, but maybe we'll get lucky and make it out of here. And I might just expose the rules to them at that point and say, okay, look, I'm looking at the map. It looks like you're going to get four wandering monster rolls before you get out of here. Let's just roll them in front of the screen and see what comes up. And let's agree that if a wandering monster hits, then you're killed and you don't make it out. But if they all come up, you know, misses, then great, you made it out and you survived.
Right, and Joshua is
accelerate.
Yeah. Good point. And Joshua was saying the exact same thing in the chat while you were saying that. Joshua was saying, when I was young, I would have them, I would let them try to figure it out on their own. Now I'd warn them specifically every turn. I'm checking for wandering monsters. And I do the same thing, actually, is I do try to make the mechanics very transparent in my, you know, old school games, whether in a dungeon or outdoors. I very much explicate the exact rule that's happening. And like for me, I actually have a watch and in a dungeon, and every 15 minutes on the watch, you're going to get a wandering monster roll. And I even announce like we're 5 minutes away from the next wandering monster roll so that they can interface with those rules and don't get surprised by them. It's interesting. Like, I don't know if there's anybody that ever would have actually deduced those kinds of rules, but I don't think I've ever seen that happen at a table. So I like your thesis, Paul, and I like Joshua's.
So let's get back to Pool of Radiance, shall we? Excellent.
With its wandering monsters.
I'm curious, Dan, if they're with its wandering monsters. Like again, I think that is part of its charm. I think there's also this interesting thing in the game, right, where if you you may or may not surprise the wandering monsters, and then you can approach them and you can talk to them, and then it gives you a bunch of options about what kind of demeanor do you give, right? Are you haughty or sly or meek or nice? Right. And so there's a little bit of role play in that game of like, let's see if I can get something out of these monsters, or let's see if I can talk my way past them by choosing the right demeanor and, you know, kind of role playing.
Interesting. That must be under the parlay menu that under the parlay menu. Okay. I haven't actually clicked on that
yet. Okay. Yeah. If you parlay, there's a bunch of options of what kind of demeanor you want to parlay with.
Okay.
And they might leave you alone, or they might still attack. Yeah, and you may not have also noticed that sometimes the monsters appear fairly far away, and there's this option to advance on them. Have you noticed that? That actually dictates how far apart the figures are at the start of the battle.
Okay.
Right, so if you advance and then get into combat, you're right in there. You're face to face. Whereas if you just jump into combat right away, they might be a couple screens away.
Interesting. I mean, one thing I noticed last time that was nice is you can, within a round, you can swap weapons out. So you can, I've got a missile weapon and switch to a sword within the round. And for what it's worth, that's actually something I don't allow in when I'm actually running a game, is it takes a round to swap weapons in which you can't attack. And I feel like that's actually sort of what happens, at least in the first edition example of play. That's a good point, Paul, because then that would support me using missile weapons to begin with and then switching to melee when I need to.
Yep. I actually have a question for you about how this maps to the actual AD&D rules, because here's an action that I didn't realize exists or don't remember existing anywhere apart from this game, which is one of the things you can do with your turn is guard, and you can only do it if you have a melee weapon.
Yeah.
And what that does is it puts you in a state such that if a monster comes in contact with you, you immediately get a swing on them.
Interesting.
Is that a thing in AD&D?
No, I was wondering what the guard was doing myself, because I did not know what that was.
It's like a held action. There's no held actions or anything like that in AD&D?
Not in the book. There isn't in the book, to my knowledge. I feel like maybe it's, you know, what we now call an attack of opportunity, possibly.
If you're in melee and you leave, you can get attacked.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So granted that, I think that guard is seems to be a unique addition, I think.
Yeah. That's what I thought. So I find I use that a lot in the game of like strategic guarding of when to guard.
Right.
What was the other thing in the game that's similar? thought that was another thing. Anyway.
One thing you told me about in the past. Well, one thing you told me about the past, obviously, because we talked about it more than once last year, actually, is what this, you know, in this game labeled it the sweep attack rule. The fact that if you're a fourth level fighter and you're fighting first level monsters, you get four attacks per round against them. And my thesis now is that is the single biggest rule bifurcation between original D&D and advanced versus the basic line that didn't have that rule, is a major difference. And you told me in the past that being mostly a basic D&D player, you were really surprised by that rule when it popped up in Pool of Radiance.
Yeah, I think most of the things I know, they call it sweep in Pool of Radiance. Most things I know about sweeping comes from playing that game, not from actual like tabletop, but from playing Pool of Radiance, because it drastically changes your tactics. When you have a bunch of first levels, you're very concerned about forming a line, right? Because you don't want the monsters to break through and get at your soft magic user in the back or whatnot. Whereas, if you're fighting a bunch of goblins, and I don't want to spoil too much for you, Dan, but let's just say there are fights where there are more numerous enemies. And so when you have like a third or fourth level fighter, you want to push them in there. You want to get them surrounded. Like, yes, please surround my fourth level fighter with goblins, because they're probably not going to hit. And then I get to sweep a whole bunch of them. And it's amazing. It's one of the most deadly tactics in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a big difference. And I still am not like my heart is still not 100%. I actually do run my games with that rule, because I do feel like it's an important part of classic D&D. But my math brain is not super happy with the quantum shift between, I'm fighting a first level monster versus I'm fighting a second level monster, and how completely radically different the mechanics are. And someone pointed out on Twitter for me this morning, actually, and I would have made this mistake, honestly. They pointed out that whereas in original D&D, the rule was just any one hit die monster was susceptible to that. And then in first edition, the clause was just minimally changed to say monsters under one hit die are susceptible to that. So that actually, the main thing that changes is, in original D&D, the canonical example was I'm fighting orcs and you get this advantage. And then in first edition, you don't get the advantage against orcs because they're a full hit die. And I absolutely would have run. I would have made that mistake, because you specifically don't get it against orcs. It's only goblins and kobolds.
Wow.
And that's huge difference. If I'm eighth level, that's a huge difference between one attack or eight attacks, based on that tiny little clause difference.
Yep. Yep. Fantastic.
So I'm glad I was reminded about that this morning.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I'm kind of curious, because you opened the discussion with this, Dan. Is there anything you want to know about the game that's driving you nuts right now that we can help you out with?
I don't mind the mystery, actually. So information about the interface is actually useful. So if you see me, if you're watching a Thursday show, and you see me go, how do I do this? How do I do this? How do I accomplish this? Feel free to tell me what to do. And Paul, you were actually helping me out with what happens in the shops with they're going to automatically change the money. You can pool your money, and then you can automatically share it back among the party members, which was something I was missing out. So you'll probably see me do that this Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah, encumbrance tracking is a thing in this game for sure. And like not carrying around hundreds of silver pieces is actually really important.
I find that satisfying, buy
something, some minor, a couple of darts just to get the shopkeeper to kick in and trade up my money. Inversely, some of the NPCs will quote prices in platinum, and I don't think it actually has to be platinum. I think there's other places besides the inn, but I think there are places where they say it costs this much platinum, but you can just, I don't remember, what is it, it's like 20 to 1? Is that what it is in AD&D? 20 to 1?
It's 5.
Gold?
It's 5.
5 to 1, sorry.
Yeah.
Yep. 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 Right.
Yeah. It is actually kind of funny to work through this really super old school interface with no mouse and all that kind of stuff. And I actually do find it compelling. I am actually really curious about what shows up next and how I'm going to get through it. Granted, how completely mercilessly brutal it was to barely pull my ass out. And of course, I will say, right, thanks enormously to a couple people who thought that I'd intentionally started with no cleric. And a couple of people was like, obviously Dan made a party of four with no cleric because he's intentionally doing that. And the crazy thing is my brain just doesn't actually see the word cleric anymore. So I did not intentionally do that. And I really needed a number of people say, you know, dude, you're going to need some healing spells to get through this, get a cleric. And so I introduced a cleric in session two. And if there's some other tactical giant mistake I'm making, please somebody jump in and tell me to fix that. So now I have a cleric in the party.
Yeah. I do wonder what the math is behind the wandering monsters and if they're scaling it at all to your party size. I'm kind of curious if like the numbers of enemies in the wandering monster rolls get bigger based on your party size. Which might be an argument for like actually there is a reason to only use four versus six. I don't know.
It's an interesting question, and that's an ambiguous place in original rules, right? Actually, and the funny thing is, technically, original D&D says to do that. Actually, says that you should be scaling the monsters to your party size. And you know what? There's even a tiny little bit of a rational reason for that. Is you have a bigger party, they're making more noise, and they're attracting more monsters. And there's even a little bit of a rationale for that, actually. But I don't know what it is in this code base.
All right, Dan, roll out here. One of the things, since you are streaming playing Pool of Radiance on Twitch, I will point out, like, my experience with Pool of Radiance on Twitch is one of the interesting things is that's where the speedrunners go. So some folks like to speedrun this. So I'm looking at speedrun.com. Can you guess what is the record for fastest run through of this game?
I'm pretty confident. I mean, based on my deep experience and my deep knowledge of the Dungeons & Dragons rules, I'm confident in saying no one could possibly do this in less than 6 hours.
Okay. The speedrun, according to speedrun.com, top speedrunner is Rich B., who did it in 10 minutes and 46 seconds.
What the fuck? What? Are you fucking kidding me? 10 minutes?
10 minutes.
Are you kidding? Are you shitting me? What is this? What the fuck?
I can't imagine. I cannot imagine. I don't know how you do it.
What? What a crazy world we live in. That's insane. Yeah. Wow. Huh.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it involves a lot of skipping content, right? Of just like, you just need to hit these things and you get to the game over screen, right? Like, just as fast as you can. Go, go, go. Get lucky. Get the right things. Yeah.
That's unreal. Okay, well. Good job, whoever that was. Crazy. Okay, well, I'll look forward to I mean, I've already played it for 4 hours, so probably about 11:10 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday I should be done, so look forward to that, everybody.
Oh, dear. All right. Viewers, I'm sure that there are links in the video description if you want to find out where you can play. It's definitely still available. Dan's playing it on Steam. I think there's some other places you can find it, I'm sure. If you have any interesting insights to the Gold Box series stuff, or like stuff you really want to see Dan tackle in Games from the Elder Times, leave us a comment in the video, in the YouTube chat here. We would love to hear from you.
Definitely, definitely. And remember that, of course, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs, and we're on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and GitHub and TikTok. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so look for us there, and you'll get updates on upcoming shows.
If you prefer to listen to our shows in audio-only podcast format, you can find those podcasts at our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find them through various podcast carriers, such as Google Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes. If you're listening to this right now on one of those carriers, please take a moment to rate and review us there. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DMs show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and you'll see our different tiers, discounts on merch, access to a private Discord server, other benefits. And of course, our favorite part of the week is continuing the conversation Sunday afternoon right after this show in live video chat on Discord. So if you haven't done that yet, please join our Discord via Patreon, and we'll look forward to continuing the conversation in about 10 minutes over on Discord. You know, Paul, I got to say one thing. I really like our color coordination today. I like you. We didn't plan that, but I actually really like you and me in different primary color shirts. That's for some reason that works really well. I don't know if that's a throwback to the Big Bad or something like that, but that makes me very happy for some irrational reason.
It's a little like we're evoking our Team Fortress 2 real life play, live play.
That's it. I think you're right. I think that's it. Anyway, so please visit the channel late Thursday night, which is 11 p.m. Eastern time, to watch me swear and struggle and beat my keyboard as I try to get through Pool of Radiance for the first time. And please pitch in any help that you can possibly give me in the comments, because I think I need it. What a great game classic D&D is, really. What a great merciless. Yeah. You really have to be at the top of your game, so I'm looking forward to more of that on Thursday. And, of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so please join us again here next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see.